This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we'll talk with Andy Downs, who's the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics in Fort Wayne, to get his analysis of yesterday's Governor Eric Holcomb's second State of the State address that the governor made before a joint session of Indiana legislators last night at the State House. Also, too, we'll have a conversation with Heath Carter and Byron Martin from Valparaiso University about this year's Martin Luther King Day, which is coming up on Monday, January 15th. And we'll also have, as well, another conversation with Keith Kirkpatrick and his guest on Lakeshore Focus. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Governor Eric Holcomb conducted his second State of the State address last evening to a joint Indiana House and Senate packed chambers there at the State House. And a little analysis on what was taking place last evening, we have Andy Downs, who is the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at IU-Purdue, for now anyway, Fort Wayne. And thanks for being with us, Andy, with an update and your take, first off, on what you heard from the governor last evening.
In many respects, it was a speech not unlike last year's speech. I personally keep waiting for the governor to do a little more patting himself on the back, so to speak. There were people who were wondering what he would be like as governor, and he's been viewed as a pretty successful governor so far, with Democrats willing to compliment him as well as Republicans willing to do so. But the speech didn't have a whole lot of here's what's going great in the state. I mean, it was a 30-minute speech, so it's not like it's packed the way a State of the Union address is. There's a little bit of that in there, and then more time spent talking about what he wants to see get done. And, of course, performance sometimes is the best politics, so maybe that's the reason that he keeps talking about what it is he wants to get done as opposed to patting himself on the back for what he has gotten done. I'm sure come 2020, we'll hear an awful lot of what he's gotten done. But my impressions about the speech beyond that really get to what he is trying to define, I think, as the most important issue this session, and that would be workforce development, very broadly defined. And he got there by talking about what sort of jobs have been coming to the state, what he hopes to have continue to come to the state, and then addressing what is perhaps our most important issue when it comes to workforce development, figuring out how to make sure we have the employees to actually fill the jobs that are being created here. We have a pretty low unemployment rate right now, and that may be one of those things that helps to turn off businesses from coming to the state, locating here, and creating more jobs.
In fact, I noticed, too, that even the whoever attended for the Indianapolis Star, as well as the Associated Press, and particularly the AP State House team, had mentioned the fact that they didn't see much boldness or leadership on the part of the governor in his address last evening. And the Indianapolis Star went into it in their previews before last night's comments, saying that they were waiting to hear from the governor. They wanted to get more indication of how the governor is going to be like here for the second term of office, or second year in his term of office, I should say.
Yeah, it is. It for a lot of people, it's a very boring speech. It's straight ahead. It's simple stuff. It's not rocket science, so to speak. Not much in the way of bold initiative. Some people are pointing to the initiative regarding infant mortality as perhaps the bold initiative this time around. But it's in keeping with what he said last year. It's in keeping with what he talked about on the campaign trail. And, you know, sometimes elected officials aren't particularly dynamic and exciting. A lot of people would point to someone like Eisenhower as saying there was nothing particularly bold in his administration. That might be a bit unfair. But he managed to keep things sailing in the right direction. And in some respects, when you look at low unemployment, when you look at growing wages, and when you look at jobs being created, there are a lot of things to say, just keep the ship moving in the same direction. Now, people can argue about every one of those facts that I just mentioned or find other facts to counter them, but there's enough of a case that someone can make that things are going well that the governor can choose to say, my job is just keep things going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we know, too, that one of the most important things that people are waiting to hear more from the governor about, that I understand that he did mention in the final minutes of his address last evening, was talking about the problems at the Indiana Department of Child Services, the problems that were outlined by Mary Beth Bonaventura, the former director of the agency, as she was leaving office.
Yeah, that was a very scathing letter when she stepped down. And for a lot of people, they believe there should be some sort of action right now, that the legislature should engage in oversight. Democrats clearly are calling for that. And I think their calls for it go beyond the normal partisan bickering that we see from time to time in the General Assembly. I think that they really are curious about what has happened, and they want some answers to questions. The Republicans have chosen to back the governor's approach, and the governor's approach is an interesting one. It's one that's worthy of discussion in that a group has been hired to come in and take a look at what's happening and then to offer some recommendations, and sort of he's sort of taking a hands-off approach until then. But a lot of people say, no, there should be something happening now. We shouldn't have to wait for that report. There should be some hearings done right now so that the General Assembly could choose to take action during the session as opposed to waiting until after the session. The governor's made it clear he's willing to call a special session if you think that's necessary. Yeah. So this is, you know, this is interesting. It may continue to bubble up in a way that forces the General Assembly to take action. For example, if there are some horror stories, if a child dies, or if there are multiple abuse cases that are really horrific that come to light in the next couple of weeks, it could be the General Assembly has no choice but to address them.
Yeah, I was going to say that we know that that Mary Beth Bonaventura had mentioned in her letter and some other comments as well too that most of her concerns about how the DCS was dealing with cases were because of the fact that we have the opioid crisis in Indiana, and even the governor kind of addressed that in his speech last evening about the fact that he wants to see some beefed up efforts and some different ways to approach the problem.
Yeah, the opioid issue is, unfortunately, it's a growing one. It's not one that's shrinking. We'll have to wait and see how these things work out. The opening of a couple of new clinics or several new clinics obviously will help, but people still have a long ways to travel, and there's always the issue of getting people to agree that they need help. You can't really force help on people in many ways. So we'll see what happens there. There's a lot of talk about it as an issue, but at the same time, other than opening some new clinics, other than the INSPECT database for pharmacists, some people I think are probably going to end up saying that really is not enough when it comes to opioids.
We're talking with Andy Downs, who is the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics in Fort Wayne. He was there to hear what Governor Eric Holcomb had to say during his second State of the State message last night in Indianapolis. And I guess we should probably ask your reaction. First, let's get the expected reaction that we'll get from the Republican leaders of both houses. What do they seem to say about what they heard the governor say?
Yeah, the leadership obviously loved what they heard. This is in line with what they're doing. It's helping to bring some focus to a legislative session that they admit could be a little chaotic. So they like it for that reason as well. The Democrats had the obvious criticisms. There's not enough in there in terms of specifics about the opioid crisis. There's not enough in there in terms of investigation into DCS. But there also are some places where there will be some common ground in terms of, for example, helping people who are in prison earn either a high school or college degree or post-high school training so that when they come out, they're actually much more employable than when they went in. So that there's room for agreement, which is what this governor has in his one session built a bit of a reputation for doing. Mm-hmm. But we'll have to wait and see how it plays out. It's an election year, but only for those who are in the House and the Senate, and half the members of the Senate, I should say. So it's not like it's 2020. It's not like the Democrats have to worry about trying to tear down Holcomb while the Republicans have to worry about propping him up. One of the things I'm waiting to hear, though, is actually from those within the Republican Party who are looking for a little more action on social issues, because that was pretty much absent from the state address.
I was going to ask you if what you've seen so far, I know that we're very early into this 2018 General Assembly session here, but what has been said so far about whether any measures are going to come up here or dealing with some of these social issues that you've referred to?
Well, they're certainly going to come up, and some of them a bit more likely to come up than others. Obviously, the alcohol issues are in some way, shape, or form are going to come up. We've had chairs of committees already say they're going to give certain things hearings. The stuff that's a bit more contentious, for example, from over my way, Kurt Nisely introduced some legislation that would basically ban all abortion. That's probably not going to get a hearing. The argument that supporters of that legislation are making is that it's time for a case to make its way to the Supreme Court. And the reason they're making that argument is because people, even those who are pro-life, many of them are saying that's clearly unconstitutional in the current definition of the of the Supreme Court justices. But, you know, those who want the more rigorous definition or more restrictive definition are saying, no, it's time to send something to the courts. Let's be the case that gets there. Let's be the state that sends the case there. So there's going to be a lot of talk about that, but I'm not sure there will be hearings. A lot of people remember that last year, one of the chairs of the committees, who is a pro-life, card-carrying pro-life member of the Republican Party, refused to give a bill a hearing because he said that it's just clearly unconstitutional, and people actually picketed his church. So, you know, there is a growing tension here that both Long and Bosma, as well as the chairs of the committees, are going to have to try and navigate, and whether that means giving some opportunities for hearings without votes, whether it means putting some things up for votes, we'll have to wait and see how that plays out.
And one other area, too, that we haven't heard from, at least not yet anyway, is from the LGBTQ community and the activists that have been out there. They have wanted to push for some more efforts made, again, dealing with the things like RFRA. I'm sure that probably will get slipped into the session, too, if there's time.
Well, it will. I mean, people will talk about it. There are a lot of folks who actually, in response to RFRA, saw local governments taking action.
Right.
And so some folks said, all right, fine, I'm just going to focus on my community, see if I can get my community to adopt some legislation. But that certainly didn't stop the statewide effort from saying we need something to happen at the state level. Republicans, you know, they said they were going to give something a chance the year after RFRA. The legislation failed very quickly and without a whole lot of fanfare. And they can say, we gave it a chance. We can set that issue aside for right now. But it probably will come up again, as will hate crimes and a couple of other things, but probably not in the substantive way that something like Sunday sales will get.
So maybe in looking back now at what had happened before the joint session of Indiana House and Senate, no big surprises from Governor Holcomb, certainly. A lot of his efforts for his agenda for this particular session mentioned, as you mentioned as well, too. And if anything else gets added to the mix, I guess we'll just have to wait and see, eh?
I think so. You know, every session we think we know what's going to happen. We think we know what the big issues are going to be. And on a pretty frequent basis, something surprises us. So there's always still that thing for us to wait and get surprised by. But things are taking shape, and obviously they're meeting and starting to get things done for us in the state. But we'll have to wait and see. We have many weeks to go still.
Andy Downs is the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Indiana University, Purdue University, Fort Wayne, soon to become Purdue University, Fort Wayne. As always, Andy, thank you very much for being with us to give us your take on what the governor had to say during his second annual State of the State message last night.
Thank you very much for having me.
Ivy Tech Community College's new strategic plan calls for growing enrollment of more than 25%. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Eric Weddle tells us that it aims to achieve that goal in the next 5 years.
Ivy Tech President Sue Elsperman wants to more than double the number of students earning certificates and degrees annually to 50,000 by 2023. She also wants to grow enrollment from about 94,000 students to nearly 120,000 students. To help reach that goal, the college is working on improvements, including changing its academic advising and adding 8-week courses. Ivy Tech's 5-year plan comes as the state seeks to increase its overall college attainment rate to 60%. Lawmakers have pressured the college to increase graduation rates and take a leadership role in prepping the state's workforce. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Eric Weddle.
As we approach the Martin Luther King Jr. Day, celebrated across the nation as well as here in Northwest Indiana, we find a number of universities that are going to be doing their annual observances of the life and the work of Dr. King. One of those coming up is going to be at Valparaiso University. And we have with us to talk about the upcoming program Byron Martin, who is the Director of Multicultural Programs at Valparaiso University. And with us we have as well Dr. Heath Carter, who is on the Valparaiso University faculty and who is the co-chair of this year's program committee. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Glad to be here. Thanks so much.
Well, if you will, tell us first how important this particular day is. We observe Dr. Martin Luther King often in a lot of respects, but this time of year in particular in January is when we want to focus the most on the man himself and his work and all. How important is this particular day in observing the life and work of Dr. King?
Well, as you know, Chris, I mean, obviously, King Day around the nation and here is a you know an important day for remembrance. But it's also, I think, it's especially important. We're in sort of 50th anniversary row here, remembering those momentous years in the mid 1960s. Obviously, 2018 marks the 50th year since Dr. King was assassinated. So, you know, giving us a real opportunity to reflect on how far have we come and how far do we have yet to go.
Do you think that perhaps it's particularly special this time of year and this particular year because it's the 50th anniversary?
Well, I just think, human beings like markers, and 50 years is an important marker of, the Civil Rights Movement was in many ways a kind of epochal social movement that really changed the nation, it changed the world, and yet we're here 50 years later trying to figure out what was the nature of that change and what has yet to change. You may know that, you know, toward the end of Dr. King's life, he really pivoted in the wake of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act, to thinking about even larger issues that were issues for right here in the United States, but also around the world, issues of racism and poverty and war. And surely, you know, as we mark 50 years, we can say that, you know, we've come a long way since 1968. And yet there are ways in which some of the problems that King was talking about in the days leading up to his assassination in Memphis are even thornier today than they were in 1968, something like economic inequality. We're actually at a moment of historic inequality in the United States, much more unequal, economically speaking, than we were at the time of King's death.
As we celebrate this event coming up on January 15th, it's for Valparaiso University will be the 28th annual celebration of the life and work of Dr. King. The idea that is the theme this year is Why We Can't Wait. Tell us why that was chosen, please.
The theme, Why We Can't Wait, actually comes from a book, the title of one of Dr. King's books that was written in 1964. It was a book where he was really couching why we can't wait for things like the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act to happen. Many of the folks that were believers in King wanted him and his followers to wait for those acts to be enacted. There were other things and other levels of unrest that were going on, and they told King, hey, we think this stuff is important. We just think it shouldn't happen right now. And King wrote this book of Why We Can't Wait, because it's important for us to have these freedoms and this access right now. I think we chose it because I think we sit at a paramount time where there are a lot of entities and a lot of vestiges and policies and laws that people are saying, hey, just wait to change that. That's not going to affect us right now. And the truth of the matter is that several people in our nation are going without access to important things such as health care, important things such as economic inequality that Heath was talking about, and having access to those things and access to those different policies that need to be changed. We're saying we really can't wait, and we need to analyze those things closer and see what we need to do to make our nation more equitable.
We're talking with Byron Martin, who is the Director of Multicultural Programs for Valparaiso University, along with Dr. Heath Carter, who is on the Valparaiso University faculty and who is the co-chair for this year's event, the 28th annual celebration of the life and the work of Dr. Martin Luther King. And it's a very, very special day. In fact, a day-long event, I understand. Tell us, if you will, what's going to be happening through the day on the 15th, adding up, coming to the point where we have the very special keynote speaker, Nicole Hannah-Jones.
Definitely. Well, I'll tell you a little bit about the day. So we're starting the day off at 8:30 in the morning with a welcome and charge. This is going to be an opportunity to kind of engage around some key topics and key facts just to get everybody ready to go. And then at 9:30, we go into our focus sessions. Focus sessions have really been a highlight of this event for years. Our focus sessions now look like four individual TED Talks. And so they really look following the tracks of four different important subject matter. So we're covering race, labor, environment, and and violence and how those play in our local communities, thinking about here in Northwest Indiana. And then we'll have a luncheon that will be characterized by a light introduction to the work of Nicole Hannah-Jones. And then we'll go into our 2 p.m. convocation featuring Nicole Hannah-Jones, as well as the awarding of several awards around the MLK award ceremony. Mm-hmm. So that'll be a piece of the day, and we're excited to have Nicole Hannah-Jones.
Yeah, she's one of the nation's leading investigative reporters. She writes for the New York Times Magazine. She won the prestigious MacArthur Genius Grant this year, one of the world's most prestigious awards for her very creative, provocative work at the intersection of race and education. You know, she's really been arguing for a couple of years now that for all the talk about education reform and all the different ideas that folks have about how to close the inequality, the racial inequality gap in American education, that we really know that, you know, one thing that surely works and that has been proven to work is desegregating the public schools. And yet there's not the political will for that kind of desegregation. So we've been, we're delighted to have her come and spark a conversation here that's a vitally important conversation, obviously for this region, but also for the nation as a whole.
Is there anything in particular that you know of that Nicole is going to mention in her remarks, either in her speech or perhaps afterwards?
We know that definitely she's going to talk about education inequality and the importance that institutions like ours and the space that we exist here in Northwest Indiana play in the conversation about education inequality. As we know, Indiana is one of the largest producers of what is known as the school voucher. And the school voucher programs, Indiana gives out more than any other state. And so that's going to be a topic that we know that will be talked about but analyzed by Hannah-Jones mm-hmm. as well. In the donor dinner, there will be an opportunity for people to ask her specific questions about how education inequality plays a role even here in Northwest Indiana and get some direct advice and thoughts from her there.
And we know this, as we mentioned earlier, a day-long event in particular as we celebrate the life and work of Dr. King, and in particular there at Valparaiso University. If anyone's interested in attending the event and participating and listening in and talking to Mrs. Jones, where can you find out more information?
Definitely. So we would ask that to go to valpo.edu/MLK, and they'll be able to register for the day and see all the incredible things that we have going on, such as the movie that will be happening. We'll be hosting a viewing of I Am Not Your Negro, mm-hmm. The James Baldwin film on Sunday at 4 p.m., and that's open to the community as well. And so they'll be able to see all the other experiential aspects about the day at the website as well.
We're talking with Byron Martin, who's the Director of Multicultural Programs at Valparaiso University, and with us as well, Dr. Heath Carter, who is on the faculty of Valparaiso University, and he's also the co-chair for this year's program, the 28th Annual Celebration of the Life and Work of Dr. Martin Luther King. It's going to happen on the VU campus on January 15th, 2018. You can go to the website and find out more information and sign up to be sure that you're able to participate in that. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us, and the best of luck to you in the event coming up here on the 15th, and we hope that many people attend and take something away that they can use not only in their lives, but maybe a bit of activism for the future as well.
Thanks so much,
yeah,
sir.
Thanks for having us.
Purdue University Northwest will host East Chicago native and U.S. District Court Judge Gonzalo Curiel at two Martin Luther King Jr. programs next week. Judge Curiel's address will honor Dr. King's legacy and vision and reflect on the program's theme, Together We Win with Love for Humanity. The coordinating events will happen on Monday at Westville and on Tuesday at the Hammond campus. Judge Curiel's been a federal prosecutor as well as a judge, but picked up some national notoriety back in 2016 as being the judge in the Trump University civil case. He denied a request from Trump attorneys for a delay in the case. During the campaign, Trump repeatedly criticized Curiel in speeches and interviews, calling him a, quote, hater of Donald Trump, unquote, saying that his rulings had been unfair and suggesting during the speeches that the judge's ethnicity might have posed a conflict of interest in light of Trump's proposal to build a wall on the U.S.-Mexican border. Trump later said that his comments were misconstrued, and Curiel said later that he concluded that, quote, Donald Trump has an odd way of showing his appreciation for a trial judge who, as his attorney said, is just doing his job, end quote. There'll also be corresponding Martin Luther King Jr. presentations on the IU Northwest campus in Gary as well. This is Regionally Speaking. It's time for another Lakeshore Focus Conversation with Keith Kirkpatrick and his guest this time, taking a look at the top news stories of the past year.
I think it can be clearly stated that 2017 was an unusual and stressful year. It's over. But the history of what happened in our region and the stories that stayed with us impact us even now. What were the big stories? What touched our hearts, aroused our fears, or made us think? Here with us in our studio are two of my favorite people who happen to be journalists from our two major newspapers in this region, Krista Zivanovic with The Times and Jerry Davidge with The Post. You know, this is our sixth year doing this.
I didn't realize it was six.
And you guys look much better than just 6 years old. I mean, I think you're a little older than that probably.
Don't show us the earlier ones.
Yeah. Right?
We don't want to see how we look 6 years ago.
So, yeah. But just think when we get to the 10-year mark or something doing this show.
I would love that.
Willing.
Yes. I'll bring a champagne.
Okay. So this is good. So let's just jump right into it. Top stories. You guys always give some thought.
Christy, you want to go first?
No,
last year's top story?
You go first, Jerry.
Well,
you know,
there's some big heavy hitters from last year, and I thought Lake County Sheriff John Buntzich, of course, being...
That was number one on my
really?
List.
Really? Is that... That's because people talk about that the most. Yep. That's why I bring it up, what people are talking
well,
about
the
most.
Well, it's the gift that keeps on giving, but
oh
go ahead.
Oh, my God, in this region...
What does that mean for a journalist, the gift that keeps on giving?
Well, then
you get to
we
write
had,
about it more
well,
more?
We had the issue with the sentencing.
Yes.
You know, that was prolonged. And somehow the Times got involved in it because our columnist, Mark Chase, had written a column just innocently. I mean, he wasn't meaning anything negative. He just said, I'm going to publish all the names of the people who write letters of, you know,
in
sympathy
support.
And commendation in
yeah.
support of him
right.
to mitigate the sentencing. And he said, you know, that's my prerogative. Suddenly an article appears in the Indiana Lawyer about how the press is inserting itself in the news and this is egregious and shameful and we shouldn't do it. But another professor was quoted in the article at the end saying it's all public record, and if they want to list those names, it's up to them, and what's the big deal?
It was fresh, a bit unusual.
How do we always end up with a story of corruption as one of the
Well, we didn't have to lead with that,
because
I was going to lead with national news that ripples into Northwest Indiana. But it matters in this region, and people know it, and we have a bad, infamous reputation, and people don't forget that. So when they contact me, they say, when I asked for certain stories from last year that stood out to them, that's the first thing I thought. Plus, it's the Lake County. It's our sheriff. It's our sheriff who's supposed to hold us to the ideals of good role modeling.
I'm
going to
divert from the script. We don't have a script anyway.
Yeah, right.
So it's interesting. You made the comment about national stories. It felt like, did national stories really almost overshadow the local stories this year?
Definitely did.
It felt like
And
it.
They rippled into our region, especially because
right.
Trump. We can't get a day
right.
in our newspaper business without mentioning the word Trump.
It's really true.
It's crazy.
And what do you mean by rippling in? How did
well,
it ripple
Well, we get
in?
Calls all the time, and I'm sure you do too, about criticizing us for headlines that are not favorable to him
or
headlines that are too favorable to him
yeah.
or why are you putting this news in the paper or why isn't there enough?
So we've always had national news seeping in or rippling into our region. Obama, when he was president also, but especially now with Trump, he divided everything. And our country's divided, and our region is divided. And our readership is divided because of that. I mean, I've lost some readers from a columnist perspective, and I've gained some just because of that factor. So everything has Trump's stamp on it, whether we like it or not. I mean, you know, he's an egomaniac who loves his name everywhere, and he's got it everywhere now.
And for Jerry in particular, Jerry has said, you know, I'm going to keep writing about Trump now, even though, you know, both papers, columnists and reporters, our bread and butter is local news, but the local people can't get enough of Trump either
right.
for or against. So Jerry has said, this has become a local
yeah.
story.
And where's the chicken and the egg
right,
there?
Exactly.
You know, but it's interesting, the sexual harassment charges that have been all over the country, that's one that hasn't really bled too much in the area. We haven't had...
Surprisingly so.
Well, wait. You know, we tend to lag behind a little, so things
What are you trying
might,
to say, Krista?
I don't know.
2018,
come,
the year
yeah.
of sexual harassment charges
Who
in
knows?
The region.
We'll see. I don't know. You know, look at how long it took these national ones to foment. Years and years of
That's
cover-ups
true.
And... You know, dilly-dallying and shilly-shallying, as my dad used to say. And now suddenly
we
everyone...
We learn some interesting terms every time we do this show.
From
you know?
Krista.
They are. So how about another story from you?
Well, continuing on with Buncich, we still have Mayor Snyder, who now has asked for his trial to be put back. This is Portage Mayor.
He's definitely going to be the 2018 story.
Yes, he's going to be the 2018, this year's big story,
right.
I think. And so I just didn't want that to go unmentioned, because not that I feel sorry for Lake County and its inordinate amount of corruption, but, you know, it has seeped now into Porter County. So
there was quite a bit of press, too, on who became the replacement.
Yes.
A lot of press that
right.
for Buncich.
So this coming year, the whole Portage Mayor Snyder trial will play out, I'm guessing, and any kind of conviction or non-conviction, is he innocent, is he guilty? People are talking about it. The city is divided.
Right.
I lived there 30 years, and people are talking.
Yeah,
you're either for Snyder or against
Snyder. And
wasn't
last year the Portage Council, that things really got heated up toward the end of the year with the
very
council?
Very
you
much.
You know, he was
so
vetoing
all,
their raises.
Right.
And
it's all
saying,
it's going to come to a head this year.
Yeah.
And we don't know. And it has the stamp of corruption on it again.
I think the trial date is June 4th.
Yeah. For now.
That was the latest.
It always gets bumped back.
Politics, right?
Politics.
Here we go. Politics.
Yeah, that's exactly
definitely.
It.
How about another story, Jerry?
Well, you know, the enemy of the people, you mentioned free press. We're mentioning that. And this year has been different for me as a journalist in the last 20 years, because people do look at me differently. When you mention you're a journalist, you're in the local newspapers. Now I'm the enemy of the people. Are you putting out fake news? This is national sentiment.
You're so biased.
Kind of biased, which I have to clarify on a regular basis that I'm a columnist, so everything I write is biased, so to speak. So I have to tell people that. But other reporters, of course, that's the word you don't want to hear.
Right.
It's a dirty word.
Has this been the worst year for criticism? Personally?
It has, for sure. For us.
For sure it has,
definitely.
It just really ratcheted up where people just don't trust.
More skeptical,
trust.
More cynical. People questioning things, questioning if you're biased or not biased kind of thing. Yeah, right. So that was the year of 2017. That really captured that. And for me, being a journalist, and Krista, you must talk to all the reporters. They get the same kind of thing. You have to
definitely.
Be extra on tack for everything.
And even the people who call, I mean, they were always testy, but now they're just downright rude for the most part. I can't say everyone is, but, you know, and even when I try and explain, really, I know this reporter really does strive to be objective and fair. Oh, that's a load of, you know, hogwash.
Right.
This is almost like an unstory. It's like the story beneath, because who's really writing about it? And think about it. If you guys write about it, you're whining.
Yes, exactly. Right?
And you're just trying to make yourself look good.
Right. So we really can't do that.
Right.
So but I brought it up on your show, though.
Yeah, but this so this story goes really kind of uncovered in many ways.
It does, for the most, especially locally, because local newspapers in any demographic don't want to bring this up.
If you guys were on a national level, you'd probably get criticized, you know, or maybe fired or something. You never know.
Of course.
At the higher
levels.
We're staying
local. Yeah, we're staying local. That's why we're doing that.
Yeah, Jerry's more visible. I get to stay under the radar a little bit more, and I kind of prefer that.
Yeah,
more and more,
I
certainly
do. Especially 2017.
The phone calls do come to me, though. I mean, and I like when they're really sticky, and I can kick them up to my managing editor or the executive editor. But, you know, a lot of the time, I just have to field them because everybody's busy.
Well, I like Jerry's shirt because he took off his jacket before he came in. That big Target's on the
back.
Yeah,
right.
I always have it there.
Right,
yeah,
so you have
cool
added Jerry. You and Mark Chase in our
shop.
You guys,
the price you pay
you're welcome
it.
To it.
Yeah, right.
How about another one on your side?
Let me see. Well, for me, healthcare is a big story, and I think they're still going forward with the merger of Franciscan St. Anthony Health Hospital in Crown Point and Methodist Hospitals,
which is controversial to some
people.
Yes,
it is, and mostly because people are concerned that that would leave Community Hospital, the only non-Catholic hospital in this general area, and what that would mean, it would have implications for women with ectopic pregnancies, a lot of women issues, you know, seeking abortions or for whatever reason, or mom's life, end of care. I know that, you know, the directives from the Catholic Church and Bishop Hying are that, you know, you should not, you know, just try, it should be
part
let
of the
it run
of the
its
church.
Course
yeah.
exactly. And also, I read something recently about this notion of redemptive suffering. They're not going to give you all the morphine at the very end, the end days that you want, because there's this
how
sense
interesting.
That yes.
So it's all going to possibly
so
play out in 2018.
Gender reassignment.
Here we go.
There
we're
is
already
no
predicting stories for next year.
Yeah, no gender reassignment. So we'll see how that plays out. And you know, other our health reporter Giles Bruce did research other parts of the country where they have come up with ideas with Planned Parenthood and other clinic groups that will step in and be an adjunct to the Catholic hospital so they can still provide those services.
Right.
So we'll see how
this
it
is
works
really interesting.
Out.
This is almost, again, another, it's not quite an unstory, but there's, you've almost got to tie the pieces together to kind of see this is a very complex story.
Right. Yes. It's more than just the dollars and cents and will it, you know, will the government
morality,
approve it?
Morality, ethics will seep into this.
Yeah. It's not just a dollars and cents and a monopoly story.
Oh, interesting.
It's more than a business story. So that intrigued me greatly.
On a related note to the medical field, how about the heroin and opioid crisis?
That was next on my
list. In this region.
Yes.
We always kind of talk about it, but in 2017, I think people talked about it more than ever. The coroners, Lake County and Porter County, are coming out saying, this is a real problem.
I think
Porter County Sheriff David Reynolds said, he made videos for this saying, this is a problem, we have to address it. And I don't know if we're addressing it enough in this region, or will we in this year? I don't know either. I once was told by a heroin user, he says, being a heroin addict is a full-time job. And I don't know if our efforts to curb or curtail this problem is a full-time job in our head yet. I think we kind of just go, well, it's for a subculture or whatever we don't care about as much, but it's affecting people's lives and families who you
it's think. It's middle-class families.
It's everybody.
It's kids in high school from good families, not just single-parent homes. I know the Lake County coroner, she has finally started keeping track of the deaths from overdoses from opioid.
Well,
and
that's
drug
been
overdoses.
One of the big stories is this number, this high number.
Right.
Where they're going to set records. You know, we set records in 2017, I think, for the highest amount of overdose deaths.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is a huge, huge story.
So it was.
I know at the end of last year, Governor Holcomb did speak at Teebles and did say he agrees that this is a problem we really need. We're so far behind other states as far as detox centers, rehab centers, where to send people. I know Portage just recently, as did Griffith, their police stations are looking at it less and less as a criminal issue and more as a health issue.
Right.
And if someone comes in with an overdose issue or a problem, they won't arrest them. They will try and help them find a bed in a hospital.
Well, and they're using the word epidemic, which is really interesting. At what level do you have to be an epidemic?
Well, and here's the thing. Our local hospitals are completely unprepared for this. They, when someone comes in with an overdose, they get them out as soon as they can. If they admit someone, they have no way to detox them. It's just not anything that's on their radar yet. And I think that's the missing link that might be the next big story this year.
And that word sounds like hyperbole, Keith, when you say it, because it's an epidemic and it sounds like that. But it really is, in this region, an epidemic. I mean, it's not something that the media has generated. This isn't us.
Right.
This is the coroners
saying
this is an epidemic. This is the sheriff saying it's
an
epidemic.
And people coming to us, families, saying, please.
Please help us. Yeah, get the word out. It's remove the stigma. Because
yes,
the stigma
remove
contributes
the stigma.
To this.
Exactly.
Again, it's interesting how these stories all together because look at all the reports that came out this year about how far Indiana is behind in care for seniors and care for the mentally ill and just we're behind on a lot of these things. Our ranking is real low. We're at the bottom. So it's tied back to this, that infrastructure that doesn't really exist here to help people.
Except for being the fattest and the least fit. Then Indiana's always in the top 10.
And
we still are.
And not great on college education rates either, graduation rates.
Sometimes we do live down to our stereotype.
That's right.
We really do.
But you got another one.
You know, there's a story that really punched us all in the gut, and I just heard from somebody last week about this mentioning to me. The Hobart father who shot and killed his own daughter. He was showing gun safety to his boys, I think, in the Hobart home, and he shot and killed his daughter. Her name was Olivia Hummel.
Was she four? Six?
Yeah, I think she was six. Yeah, she was very young, and of course, it was just one of those tragic accidents.
Yeah, he was devastated, as far as you could tell from the reports.
Of course, and this is the kind of story that sticks with us, and when I ask readers, you know, think of 2017, they think of this story, sadly enough. I mean, then you have the whole gun issue coming up, and the gun safety, and gun rights, and it all, again, you start with an incident, something that happened, and it's just a tragedy, and all this politics seeps into it, Keith, and that's 2017 in a nutshell. No matter what happens, politics seeps into everything and kind of takes over this incident.
You know, it's interesting. It seems like in the previous years when we talked about this, there was always several of those kind of heart stories, or stories that really kind of tore you up.
Right.
And you're right. It's about the only one that really pops out at me at the moment.
It does. Well, that and teen suicide. There was a movie, a series called 13 Reasons Why that came out, and we had some teen suicide. That's another unstory that we are not allowed to flesh out.
Yeah.
I've written about it several times through the years, and every time I do, I hear from people who are surviving members of a teenage suicide victim. But if you look in an obituary, and I'm bad at the point, when I read an obituary of a kid, like a teenager, and it doesn't list
the
cause of death,
it.
What do I always think of
this
first thing?
This is in the same category as all the overdoses. Nobody's going to write a big story about an overdose.
Right.
I mean,
And here's the thing. We, as editors, are sensitive to, not to interrupt you, but Carmen did a story earlier in the year about a young man who killed himself, Hispanic kid.
Carmen
McCollum. Mm-hmm. And she's our education reporter. And we really agonized about how to present it, and we eventually put it on A1. We talked to the family, but the concern was you now don't want to prompt copycats. So you want to put it out there periodically, give people a laundry list of places where they can go, families, kids, resources. But then you're always so afraid,
glamorizing it in some form or fashion.
That somehow this is going to give someone else now an idea and start an epidemic or a minor.
You know, with this criticism of the press, this heavy criticism of the press this past year, do you feel you've changed in any way what you're doing? I mean, it's follow-up to comment about how you're looking at stories.
Much more sensitive to parties. We weren't sensitive enough to
photos, and yes, absolutely.
Children, juveniles,
yes.
All that has to come into play now.
Is it a good thing?
No.
Okay.
I don't think it is. It's a needed thing.
It's a needed thing, yeah. But I think maybe we've been... What aggravates me is if people only knew how we agonize every day about how we're going to present things, how long we're going to make the story, how many people we're going to talk to, how we're going to couch it.
You people are heartless, you know.
Exactly.
Biased, all that stuff.
Right.
You know, Keith, some things from last year that left us, I want to bring attention to, is the No Gary Air Show, Lake Michigan. That was a big deal. People complained about that. Hopefully this year we'll have the air show again. And also Ernie Tallarico's International Human Cadaver Prosection Program at IUN. That was pulled the plug on, and I don't know why. It's kind of mysterious, but it's gone. And that was a big deal. People from around the world would come to IUN, to this region, to study and model that program. And I even took part in it once for a column. So these are things that we're here and not here. Like, who drives past Route 30 and you don't see the Radisson Hotel there anymore?
Right.
And
it's like Star Plaza, they pulled the plug a second time.
So Star Plaza is going to be gone also for sure. So
our
landscape is changing.
That Holiday Pop Symphony was so bittersweet. There was such a pall. You know, Kirk Musbrett, so adorable. He tried to make it so upbeat and really make everyone have fun. But there was just a pall over the whole thing because...
We know it's gone.
Yeah.
So now all we have there is memories playing for us. Mm-hmm. That's all we're going to have when we drive past there. Same with the Radisson. You go, there's a big hole. We know there's going to be a future there. It's supposed to be a hotel and a complex and all that. But right now, for older people like us who've lived decades and you've been there and took your families there, it's kind of gone.
So, I think that was one of the ones on your list, right? About this, about the hotel and everything going down.
Loss is a big one for me personally, and as a journalist, I don't know if it's just because I'm getting older or if there is more loss this past year. Last year, I don't know.
Do you think there's more loss this past year?
No, I think it's affecting us differently. I think it's the same, but our sensibilities have changed. That's what I think, and I think age does play a role with it, Krista.
Yeah, maybe.
I talk to a lot of readers who are older readers, and their perspective things is different than when I talk with younger kids or students and I go to high schools and talk to them. They're hopeful and idealistic and can't wait to conquer the future. And a lot of the older people are going, well, I'm just tired of this world and I'm unhappy with the country and I don't want any part of the future.
Glad I'm going out and
glad I'm
coming
going
in.
Out. That's exactly it. It sounds funny, but it's so true, Keith.
Wow. That's amazing. Has there been any story that you really enjoyed working on this year for either one of you?
That's a good question.
You know, I really enjoyed researching, writing, interviewing, talking, making decisions about this specific story.
Well, you know, I enjoyed the women's marches that were happening in this region a lot. And people were joining and people were getting vocal. This is also the ripple effect from Trump getting into office, is that it woke everybody up. And everybody who's kind of complacent and Hillary's going to win and Trump's going to lose. And then it didn't happen that way. And they go, wait, hold on, I've got to vote. I have to get out there and be active again. I have to walk and do picket signs and demonstrations, and people are doing that all over. I went down to downtown Valparaiso, and I see these people picketing and demonstrating for causes they didn't care about last year or 2 years ago or five years ago. I enjoy seeing that and happening.
It's like, and the people who won feel so vindicated and thrilled and a little
bit
surprised.
Because they felt disenfranchised before. Right. Like nobody's paying attention to their voice. Right. So now you have this active engagement of democracy in action locally. It's fun
That's
to watch
that.
That's
a positive way to look at it.
Yeah. It is. I enjoyed that. Right?
That is a positive way. How about you? Is there a story you worked on or something you followed or that was just, you found some joy in or enjoyment?
Well, this is going to sound so terrible because I take joy in such, you know, despair and desperation. I mean, that's what I love bringing to the forefront. I worked last year really closely with our health reporter on Indiana's infant mortality rate is among the highest in the nation. And he really got down and dirty into the story. He won a scholarship to go study for a week at USC. They have a big health journalism program there. But looking at the solutions, he got to travel throughout the state because they gave him the money. And there really are some interesting programs throughout the state looking at solutions and how to fix this. But there also, we really found some things as far as pollution and other things and poverty that it felt really good bringing that to light, that maybe we could actually solve something and move forward on something. We'll see if anything comes
of it. I like that word joy, though, Keith. You mentioned the word joy. There's no joy in Mudville because the Cubs lost, as we all know. And we all just thought, they're going to roll again and get it, and they didn't make it.
And that
it
was
again.
The big story last
that
year.
That was a big story, of course.
That was a big story last year. So we're down here to the end. What haven't we covered, again, significant stories you think that we should have really paid attention to?
I think we should pay attention to the illegal immigrant issue that's taking place. They're still flying them out of Gary Airport, I believe, on a weekly or monthly basis, and people are protesting that.
Yep.
It's only going to get more increased and more intensified. In 2018, we have to address illegal immigration somehow. We're not doing it as a nation, so we have to do it kind of locally, and it's dividing people, this issue is. So that's something we're going to look at for 2018 for sure.
I would like to see us, we did pass taxes and everyone was all on board with it, and Republicans became the new group to make taxes lovable again so that we can fix our roads over the next 20 years. And I would like to see, I was shocked when I went to go get my license plate that I had to pay $80 instead of $57 because Munster adopted a wheel tax. I'd like to see us have the same joy in raising taxes a little to support schools.
Interesting.
That's interesting because as a national issue, it's on the other side of this. So, but at the local level, we're having to do
We think it's great. Well, and the passing the referendums, that's a whole nother can of shrimp cocktail we can get into later, to quote Rudy Clay, the late Rudy
the
Clay.
The late great.
Late great Rudy Clay. But yeah, I think that we really need to look at, you know, leveling that and balancing that out.
We're still too close to New Year's. She's talking about shrimp cocktail.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, makes you wonder what she
Everything
had,
relates
right?
to food. Don't even get me started. That's, you know.
So any other predictions for this year? Coming up.
This year coming up, I think someone else in the region, a public official, will be indicted for public corruption charges, even though you think it's unheard of. And how can that happen with all the corruption we've had? And you have Buntzich and you have Snyder on the docket now. I think somebody else will be indicted because the feds, once they're on you, they are on you. And they're going to find something.
And the new guy pledged, Thomas Kirsch, the new U.S. attorney for the Northern District in Hammond, pledged he's going to keep it going.
Just like David Kapp.
He's got a good staff, and he's going
to
keep David
They're here
Kapp's
to find
momentum.
That, and I think they're going to find it. So that's what I think is going to happen in 2018.
It's going to be like they used to be scared of if Mike Wallace is here to see you. If
the
FBI is here to check your records, like, man, you are in trouble.
Yeah, the feds don't mess around.
Yeah. So how about you? Anything you predict this coming year? Going to be a story out there?
I think more loss. We forgot to mention VU, the law school.
That's right.
Really revered, well-respected law school, not just in the region.
And we'll
here.
Have to see how that plays out.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know what's going to happen, but.
Well, this is always a fun show. I enjoyed having both of you here. It's always
show.
Interesting to reflect on this. Thanks for being here. Really
it was
appreciate
really
it.
Fun. Thanks, Keith. Thanks.
Lakeshore Focus airs on Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and is rebroadcast on Sundays at 9:30 a.m. on Lakeshore PBS. This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Money plays a big role in the development of renewable energy projects, and right now, solar energy is facing two big challenges in Indiana that could make solar more expensive for some Hoosiers, as we find out in this from Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen.
The first thing that worries solar advocates is the possibility of a tariff. That's like a tax we pay on things imported from overseas, in this case, solar panels. Earlier this year, two companies asked the U.S. International Trade Commission to put a tariff on foreign-made solar panels. The companies say low-cost Chinese-made panels, in particular, put them at a disadvantage, and a tariff will bolster American-made panels.
It's a really technical issue.
State Representative Dave Ober chairs the House Utility and Energy Committee.
If the president decides to enact tariffs on imported panels for solar systems, that cost gets passed on to consumers, and it eats away a lot of the price drop that we've seen over the past 10 years or so.
And if panels are more expensive, then installing solar systems becomes more expensive too. The Solar Energy Industries Association says tariffs could cost 88,000 jobs nationwide. Citizens Action Coalition Director Kerwin Olson says that would be a shame because right now, solar jobs are growing faster than any other.
It would have a significant impact. We would lose jobs in the solar industry as a whole. We may pick up some in solar manufacturing, but that would not be enough to offset the job loss that would come as a result of people canceling solar installation jobs because of increased costs.
Some Indiana companies do manufacture parts for solar systems, but most work on the installation side. Many of these same companies testified against a controversial state energy bill passed last spring that, in part, reduces incentives for rooftop solar systems, Indiana Senate Bill 309.
All of the evidence in the marketplace is showing 309 made no sense, that we would be building a wall around us, isolating us in the context of where future job growth is coming in the energy industry.
Ironically, many solar installers say the bill helped business as customers rush to install systems before the full incentives go away at the end of the year. But they don't expect that boom to last. And while many acknowledge the bill is harmful to the rooftop solar industry, there is a provision in it that cuts red tape for larger solar projects, says Indiana Energy Association President Mark Mazel.
What we're going to see is people installing what makes sense to them. So I think what we're talking about is creating options for customers.
Mazel says it's possible the bill paves the way for the state to produce more solar energy overall, even if less comes from rooftop solar. But critics still say the bill curbs options instead of creating them. Schools especially are installing more solar to reduce utility costs, and they say they need more time to profit from their investment. To that end, Rep. Dave Ober says he's drafting legislation to help.
Public entities are not as nimble as their private counterparts as far as being able to manage money and fiscal resources to do these projects. They need a little more time, a little more lead time. And so what the legislation simply will do is extend a grandfathering period.
The bill would grandfather schools for 20 years, which Ober says would give schools enough time to put money that would have gone to electric bills back into the classroom. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen.
Nick filed his report with Indiana Public Broadcasting just as the 2018 General Assembly session was about to begin on January 3rd. President Trump is expected to make a decision on solar tariffs by January 26th. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks very much for being with us. Tomorrow, it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, where we'll get reporters to talk about the stories that they filed for online as well as in print. Our Northwest Indiana Public Radio reporter Michael Puente will join us to talk about things at the State House. From the Post Tribune, Meredith Colius-Pete will join us, as well as John Gard from the News Dispatch and the Herald Argus in LaPorte County.